The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
It's time for the World of Aviation, sponsored by Academy College of Aviation in Bloomington and by Thunderbird Aviation, with locations at Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie and at the Crystal Airport. Here now is your host, Al Malmberg.
Thank you very much. This morning we're going to visit with Charlie Johnson, whose first flight at the age of 3 with his uncle literally set the course for his life. Charlie went on to have a highly distinguished career in the Air Force, rose to the highest levels of management in the corporate world, and he also was the pilot for one of the most successful golfers at all time. And Charlie, welcome to the World of Aviation.
Well, thank you, sir, and good morning.
We got to start with your Uncle Charles, B-24 Liberator pilot in World War II. You're 3 years old, and you must have expressed somewhat of an interest in flying because Uncle Charles took you up in his plane.
You know, he, as you say, flew B-24s, he flew A-26s. He was actually an instructor in the BT-13 in Arizona right before the war ended. But I was up with the family in Wisconsin, and he offered to take me for a ride. You know, I was 3 years old, so what the heck, I loved it. But when we landed, I was crying. So the whole family got very upset with my uncle about that. And the reason I was crying wasn't because of the flight. It was because it had ended. But that's kind of how I got my start. He was my idol. I used to sit, my grandfather had made a book about him. About getting into the Air Force at the very beginning of the war, and he had failed his eye exam about 6 or 7 times and finally managed the charts and finally found a recruiter that would pass him and ended up going cadets in the war. But very, very great inspiration in my life.
Do you have a lot of memories of that flight at the age of 3?
I claim to, but I'm sure that it's just, fantasizing. But it was a J-3 Cub, and he did take me up, and he did do a loop in it. But I just it just set the course for my whole life.
I'm visualizing you laughing your head off while this is all going on.
Oh, just absolutely loved it. You know, it's I've got a grandson that's the same way that I've been flying with since he was 2 weeks old, and
wow,
he is 100% hooked. He soloed at gliders at 14, you know, powered at 16, got his license on his 17th birthday. So there's some strain deep in our family that runs through. And then my son-in-law is a 787 instructor for United. So airplanes are in the blood.
You definitely had an impact on your children and grandchildren.
It's been fun. Or it is fun.
To say the least. You moved around quite a bit as you were growing up. What do you consider home, where you spent the most time?
Well, actually, the very short answer to the long question or whatever could be a long answer, I claim Wichita. I went there in right after I graduated from pilot training and went through F-105 training, then went overseas, came back to McConnell, went back overseas, and I worked for, as you mentioned, Arnold Palmer for a while. Then I came back to Wichita in flight test at Learjet and moved over to Cessna and spent my whole career there. But the other answer, I was born in Georgia during the war, and we moved to Wisconsin, and I spent the majority of my elementary school and early high school in Memphis, then moved to Chicago, graduated from high school in one of Chicago's suburbs, went to college in Iowa for a while, and then went into the Air Force. But bouncing around all over, my simple answer, I just tell people I'm from Wichita.
Now, for the first time you went up, you were 3 years old, and with the career that you had, it's obvious you got your pilot's license when you were about 6.
Yeah, I wish. I actually didn't get it till I was about 19. I was I was flying the whole time on and off, but couldn't really afford to do it. And then got my license, and then had the good fortune of going to cadets in the Air Force. And obviously, the rest is history.
When you were flying privately, when you were going after your license, acquiring that at 19 years old, where were you living at that time, and who was your first instructor?
Bob Curry, I remember his name, but I had a number of instructors. There was a guy named David Feltus, who was a good friend of mine in grammar school and high school, and his father owned a company called Arkansas Aviation, which was in Little Rock, and we lived in Memphis. And we used to ride back and forth between Memphis and Little Rock all the time, and things like tri-pacers and Apaches. And, you know, basically he gave us a little bit of instruction. And then I actually enlisted in the Air Force. They had a program called Aviation Cadets, and college didn't take very well with me. And all I ever wanted to do was fly. So I enlisted in the Air Force and actually ended up soloing in at Barksdale Air Force Base, and then was in aero clubs forever and got my license before I went to pilot training, my private, and then commercial instrument after I graduated. They had a program at that point that you could take a test when you got your wings in the Air Force and got your commercial instrument along with that. I don't know if that's a straight answer to your question.
Yeah,
it is. Kind of bounced around all over the place.
Like so many individuals, you got your CFI to get more hours in the logbook. I've read that you were a pretty tough instructor. You expected the best out of students.
Well, it's yes, and I, you know, tough is the right word, but it's kind of like the tough love thing. Is that you just, you know, you drive everybody to do their best, and it really pays off in the long run.
I've got a feeling, Charlie, in talking with you, that you made it a lot of fun for students. I just have that inkling.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and I try to. I probably soloed, 10 to 20 young people on their 16th birthday, and a lot of them got their licenses on their 17th. And you hit the nail right on the head. That's the first thing I tell everybody, is to look out the window and just enjoy what you're doing, and the rest will come naturally.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So you go in the Air Force, and you ended up you wanted to be a pilot, but you first started off as a navigator. Was that
well,
exciting
again,
for you,
the
or a
long
bit
and checkered past? Is as I say, college didn't take very well with me, so I went down to Chicago and talked to a recruiter, and they said we have a program called Aviation Cadets that we'll send you to get your pilot's wings at that time, and basically if you enlist, it gives you a much better position, and you had to have 2 years of college. I only had one, so I went ahead and enlisted, planning on going to cadets because I did reasonably well on the AFOQTs and everything. So went to enlisted, and then after about 2 years, got enough credit to go to aviation cadets, got my assignment to it, and it was to James Connolly for navigator's wings. And I said, well, I'm supposed to go to pilot training. They said, well, by the way, we stopped that program. You now have to go get your navigator's wings. And I said, well, I'll just gracefully leave the Air Force, and they laughed and said, you can't do that. So went ahead and went to cadets. Great, great experience going through that. And then after 2 years, and they told me this before, but after 2 years, I think it was a little over 2 years, a navigator applied for pilot training and got accepted. So it all worked out very well, and I would not trade the cadet and navigator experience and the experience in the B-52 for anything. It's just a wonderful. I mean, everything is good. Life's just good all the way across the board. But that's how I got there.
Let me ask you something. As a navigator, did that make you a better pilot, do you think?
From my navigator friends, I would have to say yes. The reason it did, it's just, as a flight instructor, the more you can do on the ground, the more you can sit in a chair and fly with a broomstick, the less you have to concentrate on in flight, and having the navigation skills and knowing all about all that piece of it and kind of second nature, it took away a lot of the pressure going through pilot training. And the answer is yes. It just was a nice enhancement, because back then it was all manual. And yes.
Charlie, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll start with you flying in the Air Force when we come back. Our guest is Charlie Johnson, and you're listening to The World of Aviation, brought to you by Academy College of Aviation, located in Bloomington at the crossroads of 35W and Far 94, and by Thunderbird Aviation, with locations at Flying Clot Airport in Eden Prairie and at the Crystal Airport. You're listening to The World of Aviation. You're listening to The World of Aviation. Our guest is Charlie Johnson. And, Charlie, you're in the Air Force at this point. And what was it, like 7 years before you went into cadet training and you started flying?
Well, I enlisted in 61, went to cadets in 64, went through pilot school in 68. So, that'd be right, 7 years. You know more about it than I do.
when you started flying in the Air Force, where were you flying first?
Well, I went through pilot training in the T-37 and T-38, and I went directly into the F-105. So the only operational airplane I ever flew was the F-105. I actually had gone through gunnery school in the T-33 in Myrtle Beach. So when I went to Okinawa, I kind of weaseled my way into base flight and flew both the T-33 and the F-105, but those were my primary airplanes.
And no pun intended, weaseling your way in. The F-105, nicknamed Wild Weasel. What was that plane like to fly?
There's no such thing as a bad airplane, and every airplane is good and every airplane is fun, but the 105 was so far head and shoulders above anything else I've ever been around. It's just an incredible piece of machinery. 2.1 Mach was a top end, not unusual to go 600 or 700 knots, 50 feet above the ground in it, carried 18,000 pounds of ordnance. I sound like an advertisement, I'm sure, for it, but just a phenomenal airplane.
Were you doing primarily ground support when you're talking about 50 feet off the ground, or air to air? What kind of, you flew 100 missions.
Long story on that is normally the 105 would go to 50,000 plus feet, but when you were heavy and loaded, probably 16,000-17,000 feet was a reasonable altitude for it. But you normally use the high speed, low level for ingress. Realistically, probably 500 feet above the ground, and then coming off a target in the strike model, which was a single seat, you would literally stay down at 50 feet to avoid ground fire and everything else.
Yeah.
So, and again, just I flew a whole bunch of different versions. Two of us, a friend of mine named Bob Kaufman, and I went through the same class with a bunch of very experienced people. And at that point, they decided to send two of us to an operational squadron instead of the war, which was very annoying because we were all geared up to go straight over. So I went to Okinawa and flew with a whole bunch of 100 mission guys. And then they sent us back to McConnell to check out an airplane called the Thunderstick 2, which was a D model with a whole bunch of magic electronic stuff in it. And we were supposed to go over in the first squadron with that. And the airplane actually flew beautifully when it was dry and not humid outside, but really didn't do very well in that environment. So they decided not to deploy the squadron. And we both got waivers to go from the single-seat D model to the two-seat Weasel, which was basically surface-to-air missile suppression. So that's kind of the evolution of getting into the two-seat airplane. I got about probably equal time in both single seats and two-seat airplanes.
As someone who has never flown at 600 knots, 50 feet above the ground, I want you to paint a picture for us. It sounds incredibly dangerous. And a violation of FAA regulations.
So again, I've got to give you a fighter pilot story. And if you walked into a mission, and let's say there are 100 guys sitting in the room or 100 people sitting in the room, and they say, okay, whatever you believe in, you're not going to come back except for one person. So the 99 of you are going to get hammered today, and one is going to come back. Everybody would walk out of the room saying all those other poor people aren't going to make it back today. So the danger piece is I don't mean to make light of it by any stretch of the imagination, but it's really not something you think about. It's just the phenomenal, and you know as a pilot and all the pilots listening do, it's the phenomenal experience of the airplane. It's like a Cadillac, and the faster you went in the 105, actually the more stable it got. It was just like some gigantic hand or the hand of God or whatever putting his hand on yours, and the machine was just incredibly, and it's just beautiful to watch the world go by at that speed. So,
how do you stay, Charlie? We always say fly outside the airplane. It's an old saying that every pilot almost lives by. But when you're doing 600 knots and you're 50 feet off the ground, how do you stay ahead of the airplane?
It's you hit the nail right on the head, staying ahead of the airplane. But it's just it's a frame of mind. It's training. You just it's amazing how you adapt to that. You just you're just doing things faster. But you know, instead of going 100 miles between checkpoints, you're going, or not, you know, 10 miles between checkpoints, you're going 40 or 50 miles between checkpoints. But situational awareness would amaze you, and I think anybody that you would talk to that's gone fast at low level like that, it's just your mind kind of expands to meet the challenge.
I remember Walter Payton, a great running back for the Bears. He always, when he was asked about how he ran in a game, he said everything was in slow motion. When you were an experienced wild weasel pilot doing that speed at that altitude, did things seem to slow down for you? Did you feel like it was going in slow motion?
So do you have about, I don't know when your next break is, about a minute, I'll give you an interesting story.
Fire away.
So we recorded all of our missions once, and or not once, but all the time, and I went into a debrief after I'd launched an airplane called the Standard Arm, and I was the, you know, talking in my backseater was back there, and I was saying, okay, we're over the elephant cars. We're doing 550 knots. We've got a high PRF signal we're looking at, and I'm going calm and cool and collected, steely-eyed fighter pilot. So we launched the missile, and again, I'm encapsulating a long story, but launched the missile, came back and landed. All the intel guys were sitting across the table from us, and they said, okay, Captain Johnson, tell us about the launch. So I pulled out the tape recorder and I pressed play on it, and my voice was going, Jesus Christ, it looked like I got a high PRF signal. It's going, you know, you're going like 8 miles an hour. So I learned about time compression at that point.
Did it hit the target?
I've always called it time compression. You know, if you're ever involved in an accident or an automobile or something, you talk to people and everything is slow motion. You know, say they picture the car rolling over, but it's not rolling over fast and tumbling like you see in a movie. It's just, you know, it just takes forever. So I totally believe in that.
When you're talking about 550 knots, what would that be in miles per hour?
Oh, it's probably 600 and, you know, change, 620, something like that.
Yeah,
a little bit more than that. And the other thing you do like that the 550 to 575, 525 was just a nice, comfortable cruising speed. It was just below afterburner, and that's what you'd work at. And then, like in that launch, what you do is you pop in the afterburner, pick the nose up, you accelerate, and you kind of loft the missile off at whatever the target is. So by the time you launch, you're well in excess of 600 knots, which is, you know, you're pushing 700 miles an hour.
Wow. Out of curiosity, when you would launch missiles, how fast would the missiles be going?
The missiles would go up to about Mach 3, 2.5, Mach 3, something like that. What you actually did is the Standard Arm, especially, was about a 2,500-pound missile. So when you'd launch it, it would drop off the wing. So obviously that wing would get light, and you'd just complete the roll. So you'd be upside down when the missile ignited, and then you'd go into burner. Well, you're already in burner usually, but then you'd follow the missile down to whatever you were shooting at, and it would literally mark the target for you. So You just, you know, obviously would outrun you, but you flew formation with it. But a long answer to a short question about Mach 2.5.
Wow. When you're flying at that altitude and you're going that fast, would you take enemy fire very often? Would they be able to hit the wild weasel, or was that uncommon?
We had a fairly high attrition rate. The missile coming at you was usually doing Mach 3. And you were somewhere in, you know, Mach 1 something. And what you did is they would usually launch three of them, and you could see the first two, and you'd kind of watch where it was going. And you would literally wait until you thought it was going to hit you, and then you'd count to one or two, and then you'd pull real hard. And your G capability at, you know, 1-point-something Mach was a heck of a lot better than the missile was at three, so it would usually just overshoot you. You could outturn it. So the problem you'd have then is after the first two have gone by, you'd have to pick up where the third one was, and that was usually and it wasn't always three. Sometimes it was one. I had one friend that had 17 shot at him, and he managed to evade all that. His name was Jimmy Boyd, but he evaded all that, but he was really literally very sweat-soaked when he landed.
I would say so. Did you ever get hit by anything?
I never got hit by anything. We used to call it the Golden BB. I've got a number of friends who were, you know, obviously shot down and killed, and a lot of friends that were POWs, and I also have a lot who were never hit, and it was you just never know when your number's up at anything, as you know, in life. And I just feel extremely fortunate.
How many hours did you say you had in the F-105?
Probably about 1,200.
That's an incredible record, isn't it?
Yeah, 600 in Ds and 600 in Gs. But, yeah, it's a fantastic machine. I mean, that's, as I say, I've got to be careful between all the wonderful machines that I've flown, and Learjet and Cessna especially. But it was just a pilot's airplane, just a fantastic machine.
Do you ever get the urge to jump into one of those and fly it?
All the time. Well, as a matter of fact, I've got a little box that my family knows about. You know, when you get older, it's hard to find a gift for a senior relative, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's got a picture of a whole bunch of fighters on it. And I tell everybody, rather than give me a gift, just put a nickel in it or a dime in it or $10 in it. And it's my fund. There's the Collins Foundation used to have an F, I think they still have it, but you could go fly the F-4 with them, or Rick Svetkoff, the Starfighters, has got some F-104s down at in Florida, I think the old Cape Kennedy. But I fully intend, as soon as that box gets filled up with money, to go fly another one.
You know, your story about trying to find something for a senior in the family is difficult. I bought my dad. It was so tough buying presents for him. I bought him one year for Christmas a toilet tank and a toilet. And he just scratched his head for 2 weeks before Christmas trying to figure out what these two big boxes that were wrapped up sitting next to the tree. And they were heavy, and he couldn't figure it out. I had noticed one day in the lower-level family room in the bathroom, the toilet was chipped. And I thought, I'm going to buy him one of these for Christmas, and I'll install it for him. And it was so funny watching him for that 2 weeks leading up to it. You are so right. Charlie, we are going to take a break. Charlie Johnson is our guest, and you're listening to The World of Aviation. Sponsored by Thunderbird Aviation, located at Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie, and at the Crystal Airport, and by Academy College of Aviation, located in Bloomington at the crossroads of 35W and 494. This is The World of Aviation. You're listening to The World of Aviation. Our guest is Charlie Johnson. Charlie, you get out of the Air Force, and you go to work for a food company in Wisconsin. You're flying a Beech-18. I would think that going from the F-105 to the Beech-18, now the Beech-18 is a beautiful airplane, but to go from the F-105 to a Beech-18, was it a little bit of a letdown or not?
Well, it was an interesting transition. Let down, anytime you step out of a fighter, yes. I mean, that's just, when you're sitting doing something like that. But the Beech-18, as you mentioned, was an incredible airplane. I actually flew, I got a little time in the D, which is a tail dragger, but it was a Volpar H-18 and nose gear, panoramic windows. The guy that I flew for, John Figge, was a tremendous individual. And we flew a lot between a little town called Marshfield and Milwaukee. And the bottom line is I learned instrument flying to an extreme there. I think I've got about 400 or 500 hours in the year that I worked for him. And I would say of that, 90% of it was in the clouds. And most of the approaches were ADF, so I became reasonably proficient. But it's a great airplane, to answer the question. It was fun to fly and just kind of a different perspective.
I would think that getting out of the Air Force, you had designs on becoming a commercial airline pilot.
Well, I was going two different routes. I actually had a job offer at Eastern, and that's when, everything kind of slowed up and stopped in 72 in that time frame, so that evaporated. And I'd also, my goal was to get into flight tests, and I'd applied with Learjet. I knew I was going to separate when I went over to Southeast Asia, but they required 1,000 hours in Lears and type rating, which I didn't have. So I'd aimed at high-performance airplanes, and seriously, I was planning on going to the airlines, I think, which was most of my friends were doing. But
And then life changed again. Your dad was reading the Wall Street Journal, and he saw an ad. What was the ad for?
Well, the ad said, chief pilot wanted for sports figure who lives in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and flies a Lear 24. And my dad said, you ought to apply for this. And I called dad up and I said, who is that? You know, I'm not much of a sports guy. So he said, you idiot, that's Arnold Palmer. So I applied for the job, and there was a placement agency in Cleveland. And again, this is, I hate the word I, and it's just kind of fun experiences. But, but there were like 860 applicants for it, and they narrowed it down to 60, and they sent all of us a test, and we took a psychological test, and they narrowed it down to about 10, and I flew out to Cleveland and talked with the people, and then I got down to the final five and obviously ended up with the position eventually. But, there was an ad at the time. There was something on people used to say, I got my ad through the Wall Street Journal, and I generally can say that. I got my job through the Wall Street
That's
Journal.
Amazing. Did you want to mount some missiles under the wings of that Learjet?
I did. And again, this is just an interesting story. When Arnie was talking to me, he said, well, I see that you don't have a type rating in a Learjet, and that was one of the requirements for the job. And basically, I'd gotten through the screening process, and the guy was really neat in hooking people up. But I told him, I said, well, when I was on my way for the interview, I looked in the cockpit of one, and it's a very, very simple airplane. So he thought that was a good answer.
That's amazing. Well, I've got to ask, what was it like flying Arnold Palmer around? What was Arnie
like? It was
like?
Again just incredible. I hope everybody, or wish everybody in the world, could have the wonderful experiences at whatever they do that I did. He was a phenomenal individual, incredibly people oriented. He was the best natural pilot I ever flew with. He had a set of hands on him, not only as a golfer, but as a pilot that was just absolutely incredible. Learjet's has some unique characteristics, but he could feel everything the airplane was doing, and just a good guy, a good pilot, and a phenomenal experience, meeting a lot of neat people.
Charlie, are you open for calls from our audience?
Oh, yeah.
Let's open the lines up. Our phone number is 651-289-4488. That's 289-4488. I don't think I've ever heard anything negative said about Arnold Palmer, and you just confirmed as to why that is. It's nice when you meet somebody famous like that, and they live up to what your expectations are, and it certainly sounded like he did that.
He was a genuine good person. You, again, hit the nail right on the head, which I tell people is that everything you read about him is true. He genuinely cared about people. We would be at a tournament, and all the other golfers, would be walking away. People would be trying to get autographs, and they just do a beeline for their car and leave. And I can't tell you the number of tournaments I've been at with Arnold that we would stand there for 2 or 3 hours, and he would take the time to ask everybody their name, write a little thing for him and everything, and he genuinely cared. It wasn't for the publicity. It was because he cared about the person he was talking to.
Yeah, you were hired away by Gates Learjet. It must have been one heck of a job offer, because it sounds like you had what a lot of people would think would be the ideal job. You got a great boss. You're flying a great aircraft. What lured you away from that job?
Well, basically what happened is, one of the reasons that I left the Air Force, I had made that decision with my wife, was to spend more time with my family and watch my two daughters grow. And I had actually wanted to, as I mentioned earlier, I had applied with Learjet when I was still stationed at McConnell. So I'd made some friends there, and then obviously flying a Lear with Arnold, I met a lot more of the people, and they knew that I wanted to go to work there. So they offered me a position, not just to go into production flight test, but to run it. It was that we were separating some stuff, and it was a very gut-wrenching experience in leaving Arnie, because when I went and talked to him, we had developed a very good friendship just in the couple of years I worked for him, and he made me some very nice opportunities to stay. But as I told him, my family came first, and he understood that, and we stayed friends for the entire time from then on. I used to go fly with him when his pilots would want to go on vacation. I'd go down and fill in for him. And as a matter of fact, I flew for him. We flew a Citation 10 all over the United States when he was 80. And just, again, long rambling answer to your question. It was one of the most difficult, it was the same thing as leaving the Air Force, one of the most difficult choices I ever made in my life. But it was a family priority. Plus, I wanted to do a lot more with flying. Flying with Arnie was just, from La Trobe to Los Angeles and back. We're in the world of flight tests and aircraft development, as you know. You get to do a, really expand your horizons.
Let's go to the phone in St. Paul. Vincent, you're on with Charlie Johnson, and good morning.
Yes, thank you for your service. You were Air Force, I was Navy. Question I got nowadays, we got to teach the youngsters, younger people, whatever age. Do you go out and try to do that nowadays, or like schools, or, you know, besides the service, you know, just regular schools and all that, especially nowadays with the virus and all that?
Vincent, thank you. Fair question. Charlie?
It was a little scratchy. What exactly is the question? I heard the school.
He was wondering if, I think, basically, to sum it up, paraphrase it, do you get the opportunity to go into schools and perhaps motivate students?
Well, again, yeah, absolutely, yes. I think that's the most important thing that we do in life is pass on. And that's the, so, yeah, in fact, I've got a Civil Air Patrol engagement coming up that I do whenever I can. I have not, because of the virus right now, done anything in the last couple of months, but I will, and I have no problem, you know, with the social distancing, wearing masks. But I'm involved with a lot of things. I actually sponsor Air Force Academy cadets. One of my cadets is she's a C-17 aircraft commander, and then I've got one that just started. So I try to do things with young people whenever I can. But the answer is totally yes. Anytime anybody will put up with me, if they ask me, I'm very happy to sit and give them perspectives on any type of aviation.
Do you ever sit back and literally pinch yourself going, how did all this happen?
What I do all the time, and I can't phrase this correctly because of the word I feel like I'm like the Lou Gehrig film, I'm the luckiest guy on the face of the earth, and I can't figure out how it happened. It just kind of goes back to the flight instruction, just always do your best, and when a door opens, you know, run through it and embrace it. But to answer your question, I don't have a clue how somebody like me snuck under the wire, but I'm so happy that I did, I can't even stand it.
For Gates Learjet, you were the test pilot in the production flight test. You were flying the 24, the 25, the 28, the 29, the 35, and 36, and you were just starting the 55 when you left the company. You must have been like a kid in a candy shop, as the old saying goes.
Well, it's unbelievable. Somebody gives you the keys to an airplane, you know, three or four or five times a day. And back then, 80% or 70% of what we did was VFR out in practice areas. You know, we do a lot of altitude stuff, but set and stall computer. Yeah, it was a fantastic. And we also had the opportunity to fly a lot of the advanced airplanes when they were still in engineering flight tests. So, it's like a Learjet flying club. So it was fantastic.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. Charlie, we're going to take a break. And again, if you'd like to jump in, our phone number is 651-289-4488. We're speaking with Charlie Johnson, and you're listening to The World of Aviation, brought to you by Academy College of Aviation, located in Bloomington at the crossroads of 35W and 494, and by Thunderbird Aviation with locations at Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie and at the Crystal Airport. This is The World of Aviation. You're listening to The World of Aviation. Charlie Johnson is our guest. Charlie, flying for Arnold Palmer, I would think that he knew a lot of people, and some opportunities would present themselves, and I believe one did when you met one of his friends.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Arnold's best friend was a guy named Russ Meyer, who was, as everybody knows, I believe, in general aviation, probably one of the finest leaders that have ever come out of general aviation. And Russ and I became friends. We walked the golf course with Arnie when he was playing. And basically, after I left Learjet, I mean, after I left Arnie, I went to Learjet, and I answered my phone one day at home, and I hear this knocking in the background. And I'm kind of going, you know, hello, hello, you know, and nobody was talking. I said, well, I'm going to have to hang up. I can't hear anything. He said, Charlie, stop. That's Russ Meyer. Or this is Russ Meyer. And I said, yes, sir. How are you today? And he said, great. And he said, you know what that is? And I said, no, what is that? And he said, that's opportunity knocking. And he said, we're getting ready to do some rearranging at Cessna. We'd like you to come over and talk to us. So, yes, I did. And, yes, it led to a phenomenal career opportunity.
Yeah, that was back in 1979 when you went to work for Cessna. And you did all a variety of jobs for Cessna, going all the way to the top. Where did you start at Cessna? What was your position when you began?
Well, we took production flight tests. It used to be under engineering. And we had about, I think, 17 production test pilots at the time. So I started off running production flight test and production flight quality, the quality control functions, and a bunch of other different functions that we consolidated into one thing. So it was a pretty nice management jump for me. And then, as you said, just through the luck of the draw and a bunch of other things, just about once a year, I would be assigned another department at Cessna. And ultimately, over time, ended up, you know, pretty much with the whole operational side of the company, and became a chief operating officer and president. And then a couple of years after that, I picked up the rest of the whole company with finance and marketing and everything else. But it was a very, very neat way to do things. I wish young people could do that now, to learn the whole business from the inside out, just by each year adding to the responsibilities.
You know, in reading your career with Cessna, I was surprised to read that you were hired away in the mid-'80s, about 5-6 years after you started. You were hired away, I think it was Koch Industries?
Koch Industries, yeah. That's a very unique situation, because it flies in the face of what I said earlier. But they were looking for a director of flight operations and travel, and they have a tendency to hire, and again, I don't know how I do it sometimes, I sneak under the wire, but they were looking for somebody that was really very proficient in aviation, and they kind of did make me an offer that I couldn't refuse. It was very attractive financially, and staying in Wichita, and I went over to them for about 5 years, and again, that, I tell everybody, that was my accelerated course as a business master's in business. The way they run that company is phenomenal, conservative and very people-oriented and very successful. They're, as you know, the largest privately held company in the world.
Yeah. And then it was like, what, 4 or 5 years later that you get another phone call from Meyer.
Yep, same thing that he said, you know, again, that they told me what they were looking for as a senior vice president. And I thought he was just looking for a recommendation. I said, well, I'm not sure I know anybody that's like that. And he said, well, we're talking about you. And, you know, it was, again, a greatly increased a bunch of responsibility. So it kind of balanced out. I mean, just everything in life, it just seems like, you know, doors just keep opening. And it was fantastic to be able to go back and obviously continue to expand my career there.
When you were getting out of the Air Force, did you ever imagine yourself in the corporate world, going all the way to the top of a large company like Cessna?
I did not, and that's a great question, because I meet so many young people that target, you know, say, I'm going to be president of this, or I want to do that. And my philosophy on life is more that you do, as we talked a couple of times, do the best that you can do at whatever you're doing, and ultimately life is going to peak you out. I mean, it's, you know, that... that you're not as much in control as you think of things like that. But the answer is no, I never expected to go that far. But I will also, about mid-career, when I could see the other people I was working with and dealing with and how they operated, I could see a pretty interesting, pretty clear path moving fairly high, if I'm saying that correct. I don't want to be again.
Yes.
I could see it. I knew there was something out there, and it eventually came about. But no, I didn't. When I was a second lieutenant in the Air Force, I never would have dreamed that I was going to do something like that.
Now, something I want to go into, because all pilots, you know, this is a worst nightmare, is when it comes to health issues. And you've always been a very healthy individual from everything that I've read. But there was a point where you had a cold that you couldn't get rid of it. Your children were worried about it. and you finally went to the doctor, and things just got worse from that point on. What happened, and what was it? What caused it?
Well, I've always been fortunate to have very good health, and I'd got a sinus headache, and I've never missed a day of work. You can believe that. I mean, until this thing occurred, but. And always take an executive physical and flight physical. Anyway, my regular doctor was gone, and the intern told me that my sinuses were completely infected and about ready to explode, and I had to take antibiotics, and I couldn't get off of the antibiotics. So I took them, and after about 3 days, everything cleared up and got fine. He said, no, you can't stop taking them. So I took them for 7 days, and then I started feeling worse. And they had misdiagnosed everything, so they gave me more antibiotics. And what actually happened is while the antibiotics cured the sinus headache, it destroyed all of the good flora and fauna, they call it, in my intestinal system. And you carry a lot of bacteria, you know, literally billions. And it turned some of them loose that they feel like I might have gotten in Thailand or somewhere in my world travels. And basically, I got a thing called C. diff. And they kept giving me antibiotics, which kept compounding it. And I finally talked to a very reasonable doctor. I was losing weight, and it caused me to retire and a bunch of other stuff. Finally found a guy that said, they're treating this all wrong. Stop everything. Drink a lot of water. And about 6 months later, it took that long to get back to normal. But I'm back running and have been for 15 years now on all 8 cylinders. But it was a misdiagnosis and a mistreatment.
Wow.
So, again, I don't know if that answered your question, but it's a very humbling experience. I don't know what would have happened if I would not have gotten that. I know I would have been at Cessna for at least 5 more years and different tangents. But anyway, it's all water over the dam, and I feel extremely fortunate to have gotten through it.
I was surprised to read that there's the possibility that it was something you may have picked up in Thailand way back then.
Yeah, it could have been then. You know, the doctors couldn't identify it exactly, or it could have been. Obviously, I've traveled all over the world all my life, so it could have come from anywhere. And as I understand it, these types of things are dormant in every human being. I mean, I guess one of the problems with COVID-19 right now is it is releasing things that, you know, people normally can fight.
Wow. So what are you doing these days, Charlie? Are you flying?
Well, I'm heavily involved with electric flight. We converted a Cessna about 15 years ago, converted Cessna 172 to electric. I did all the test flying on it. Then we moved to another company and did a couple of different prototypes. And that airplane, the E-Flyer, is now in the certification process and will be a certified two-seat electric trainer, pure electric power. And I've left that company. I was on the board of another company called XTI Aircraft and the TriFan 600. And I've moved over to chief operating officer of that company, and we have a flying 5/8 scale version of it out in Utah right now on a test range that we're doing unmanned. Mm-hmm. But it's a real simply, it's about a 300-knot airplane, 1,000 nautical mile range, ducted fans, takes off vertically, flies horizontally, and lands vertically. And then I still do some flight instructing and kind of sandbag with anybody who'll let me get in an airplane with them.
Do you think the future for aviation is going to be electric power?
I think it's electric, and I think it will probably morph to hydrogen fuel cells, which, you know, I think the future is alternate energy sources, to answer the question. And I don't know whether that future is 5 years away or 20 years away. There's a tremendous amount of technological or technology challenges to get there, but I do believe there's going to be a transition. And one of the reasons I love the XTI project so much is if, you know, you look at Star Wars or you look at Avatar or any of the movies, people go out into the machine and they go straight up and then they go, you know, Mach 11 someplace and then they land. But the energy source or the power source is what's going to drive that. And we're kind of we're scratching the surface of that right now.
Incredible. Perhaps we can have you back on the show to discuss that, because I have a million questions. Charlie, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I thank you so much for giving us your time this morning. It's been just absolutely fun. Thank you so
much. Well, I very much appreciate the opportunity. I hope I didn't bore everybody to death. Thank you.
Not at all. Charlie, thank you. Charlie Johnson, our guest, And you've been listening to The World of Aviation, sponsored by Academy College of Aviation, located in Bloomington, right there at 35W and 494, and by Thunderbird Aviation, located at Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie and at the Crystal Airport. This is The World of Aviation.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.